Thank you, Emma. As Emma said, I'm Sue Barclay. I'm one of the training team at All Nations Christian College, where we try to equip people for mission cross-culturally, both in the UK and across the world. And I teach a range of things related to theology and Bible and Western culture and gender and all kinds of bits and pieces. But the bulk of what I teach is a theology, and theology that takes account of the very different human contexts where theology is done. So listening to theology from Africa, listening to theology from China, listening to theology from Latin America, rather than thinking that British and American theology is the only possible valid theology. So that's what I do. And it's a pleasure to be talking to you yesterday and today about engaging with our neighbours, because this is why we're here. We're here to make Jesus known in our communities. And so thinking about how we engage with our neighbours, who are our neighbours? How can we understand them better? How can we communicate with them better? How can we share better our lives and the life of Christ with them? That's our focus for today. So I ask you to think about this question at the start of our session. Who is my neighbour? And hopefully you've been naming names. You've been thinking, well, when I think about this question, I think about my actual next-door neighbour who's hostile to me as a Christian. Or I think about my work colleague who's indifferent to my Christianity or thinks it's interesting or, you know, ridiculous, but not relevant to them. Maybe some of us have been thinking about family members who don't know Christ and thinking of them as our neighbours. People who we want to share the gospel with. We talked yesterday about the different kinds of needs that people might have in our neighbourhoods, whether that be, you know, physical neighbourhoods or the town more generally or our workplace or whatever. What are their needs? How can we be the neighbour they need us to be? How can we connect the gospel to those needs? How can we engage meaningfully and appropriately in a way that points to Jesus? So our focus today is post-Christian. Yesterday we looked at people who say they're spiritual but not religious. And today I want to kind of broaden that out a bit and talk about the post-Christian context more generally. And that includes those who might say they're spiritual but not religious, but it also includes people who have other stances with regard to the gospel. So what does post-Christian mean? To answer this question, I need to go back in time. And this is a picture of a strategic event in the history of the West. Some of you might recognise what's happening in this picture. It's the picture of Constantine about to go into battle at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And if you look closely at the picture, you can see the bridge in the far distance. He's about to go into battle with the other competing emperor of the Roman Empire at the time. And as he's about to go into battle, he has a vision of the cross in the sky, and you can see it up there, and a voice saying, "By this sign, you will conquer." He's not a Christian, but he's aware of Christianity, and so he takes that on board and thinks, okay, I've been told that if I, you know, claim the cross, I will win the battle. And so out of a very strategic, self-centered kind of motivation to win the battle, he paints the cross onto his soldiers' shields, and they win. And before this, Christianity had been very much a minority religion, very much a despised religion, technically an illegal religion, and from time to time there would be spikes of persecution. We're all familiar with some of those times when Christians were persecuted viciously in the first few centuries. After this, it wasn't immediate, but after this, a few years later, Christianity became not just a legal religion, but the official religion of the Roman Empire. And that set the course for the West, Western Europe, that region which would go on to be profoundly influenced by the Roman Empire, that set the course for it to be a Christianized space, where it was not only allowed to be a Christian, but encouraged, and as time went on, mandatory to be a Christian. And that leads us into the time that we call Christendom, the time when, you know, people would be forcibly baptized if they were of a different religion, or killed or driven out because this was Christian territory. And so Christianity and the West were entwined together because of the events that took place back in the day. And so I've used this image of entwined things growing together. And this is drawn really from Nick Spencer's book on the evolution of the West, where he talks about the way that Christianity has fundamentally shaped the West, and the West has fundamentally shaped Christianity. I hope we all know that Christianity isn't originally a Western religion. It comes from the Eastern Mediterranean, comes from that whole Jewish context. But it became a very successfully adapted to the West, and the West and Christianity grew up together, entwined like these two plants growing around each other. And so in his book, Nick Spencer says, the past, at least in Europe, was Christian. People thought in Christian. That was their worldview. That was their way of thinking. That was their way of explaining the world. People spoke in Christian. They used that language. People reasoned in Christian. You know, they sought Christian answers for what was going on in their lives and in the world. Even as the public square became more and more plural, even as more and more ideas and influences started to come in, that Christianness of the West was a key defining feature of it. Belief was ubiquitous, he says, shaping even the minority who did not believe. This was a time when the West was Christian. Now, it doesn't mean to say that everyone had a living relationship with God. It doesn't mean to say that everybody was delighting in going to church on a weekly basis. But it meant their whole worldview, their whole frame of reference was Christian. When we talk about post-Christian, we talk about the fact that there has now been a significant cultural shift in the West. Here's some words from Stefan Pass, a Dutch scholar who writes about Europe and mission in Europe particularly. And in his book, Church Planting in the Secular West, he says this: evangelical mission thinkers generally do not reflect very much on the post-Christian character of Europe. We kind of have this assumption that it still is Christian territory, that people still do speak our language, speak Christian, think Christian, reason in Christian. And that's just not the case anymore, he says. We need to recognize that we are now in a different place. The world has changed. We have changed. Europe has changed. The West has changed. And that idea that the West and Christianity are inseparable is no longer true. He says anti-religious attitudes have become endemic among the masses. I'm sure we've all got stories of this, where we've encountered those anti-religious attitudes. I can remember sometimes, you know, there might be a favourite television personality who I really like, and I really get their sense of humour, and I've really enjoyed watching their programmes. And then suddenly they will say something that shows that they just despise Christians. And it kind of hurts, doesn't it? I don't know if any of you have ever had that feeling. You think, oh, I admired that person, and now I realise that if I met them in person, they would despise me, and that's a shame. That hurts me. But these anti-religious attitudes have become endemic among the masses, says Pass, and society is deeply secularised. Do you remember yesterday, those of you who were here, I talked about that image of a sacred canopy, and I use that work of art in Ripon Cathedral of all the angels hanging from the ceiling as a kind of visualization of that. In the past, when the West was Christian and people thought and spoke and reasoned in Christian, they lived their life in that frame of reference. They made sense of the world with Christian ideas, Christian perspectives. And now society is secularized, and that has gone. For many, many people, there is nothing kind of overshadows their life in that protecting, enveloping, and making sense of it kind of way. There's nothing between them and the cold, hard vacuum of space. Deeply secularized. Here's some of the statistics that we looked at yesterday in terms of the census data, the religious composition of England and Wales, different figures for Scotland and Northern Ireland, which are not included in this, but the main census covering England and Wales revealed that in the 10 years between 2011 and 2021, there has been a shift so that now less than half of the British people in England and Wales would use the term Christian to describe their identity and their religious affiliation. Similarly, the other part of the diagram there shows that in that same 10 years, there's been a shift in the other direction of people who say, it's not that I've stopped being a Christian and now I'm a Buddhist, it's that I've stopped being a Christian and now I'm nothing at all. I have no religion whatsoever. We are a post-Christian society increasingly, and our neighbours, those who we spend our lives living amongst, will often be those who come from a post-Christian context. Let me bring you some more research data which helps to just support this idea. These are two reports which you can find online. One into Europe's young adults and religion, really looking at the beliefs and attitudes of young adults across Europe, including the UK. And the second one focused on a specific set of countries, not just in Europe, but around the world, looking at the nature of unbelief. So here's a couple of things from those research reports. In terms of no religion, those who say they have no religion in the UK, it's interesting to see how they got there. So in total, from the Understanding Unbelief report, in total, of those who now claim that they have no religion, 52% were brought up as Christian. That might be nominal Christian. It might mean they went to church on Christmas Day and, you know, took their children to be christened. It might mean that sort of level of Christian. Or it might mean that their parents were actual practicing Christians. But they were brought up identifying as Christian. And now they don't. Now they say there is no, they've turned away from that. They've found it does not connect with their life. It's not relevant to their life. And they have laid it aside. So 52% of those who now claim no religion were brought up as Christian. What's made that change? What's brought them to that point of ticking a different box and saying, actually, 10 years ago I ticked the Church of England box, and now that's no longer relevant for me, it's no longer true for me. From the other report, the young adults one, here's a really more striking figure. Of those 16 to 29-year-olds who claim they have no religion, 80% were brought up with no religion. So whereas the population as a whole, about half of them used to identify as Christian and now they don't, this younger generation are being brought up with no religion. And of course, this is only going to get more and more true as time goes by. It's only going to get more and more distant from them. They might think back to their grandparents as the last people who set foot in a church. Or maybe even their grandparents have never been to church. And people are increasingly going to be brought up with no religion. It has become irrelevant to them. They don't live in a Christianized context anymore. Within that youth report, there were some more interesting facts and figures about the UK specifically. Of the 16 to 29-year-olds in the UK, 70% of that age group said they had no religious affiliation. So this is why they're not in our churches, because 70% of people of that generation would say religion is irrelevant to them. They have no religion. This is what a post-Christian society looks like. 21% would still claim that affiliation to Christian. And if you can see there's a gap there between the 70 and the 21, there's a few who are other religions. If we think about that group, 59% would say they never go to church, never. Perhaps have never been to church except possibly on a school field trip to have a look at interesting, old-fashioned and irrelevant religions. But never. And then 69% would say they never pray. There's no concept for them of a divine being, of a sacred canopy, of a God who is looking over them. And so they never pray. It never occurs to them. Whatever the struggles or disasters they're facing, they never pray. Yes?
Sorry, is that of the 21 people who say they're Christian?
That's of the whole group. Yeah. So the implications of this are stark. When we look at this post-Christian setting, we can see that there is a real ignorance of the gospel message. These are not kids who used to go to Sunday school and never made a personal commitment. These are people who've never been to church, whose parents have never been to church, who've been brought up with Christianity as an irrelevant thing that perhaps they see sometimes on television, perhaps they see the church in their village or their town, but it would never occur to them to go there. There's a real ignorance of the content of the gospel. And I'm sure if we took time to talk to each other, we would be able to trade stories of the way that what people say sometimes reveals that they have absolutely no idea, even of the basics of the gospel message. They might be aware of the nativity story, but they don't really make a connection between that baby and the Easter story. They may not know about the Easter story at all. And if they do, they might think it's a horrible story that you would never tell your children about because it's about brutal murder of someone. You know, there's a real disconnect. And, you know, I can remember hearing stories from other people in ministry about how conversations with neighbours just revealed total ignorance. So, for example, one story was a particular pastor used to walk with a neighbour to take their children to school. And on one occasion, they always walked the same route. You know, they chatted and, you know, got to know each other a little bit. And on one occasion, this neighbour turned to her and said, "We always pass that church, and I've always wondered, who is that little man on the cross?" And this is a British person, not an immigrant person, who'd grown up in what used to be a Christian country and had always wondered, who is that little man? And why is he there? And, you know, just the depth of lack of knowledge about the gospel. This is the context we are in. We can't think of it as, you know, everybody basically knows and they just need to be encouraged to come back to church. They don't know. It's like an unreached people group. And we need to have that different attitude. Further implications are that perceptions of Christians are likely to be either negative, and often this comes from the way that we are depicted in the media, as bigoted, as out of touch, as do-gooders, as interfering, as ridiculous. You know, you think of the way that clergy are depicted in comedy, for example. Or you think of the way that Christians are often shown as hypocritical, or, you know, you think of the way that stories enter our understanding of abuse in the church and of people who've manipulated others while claiming to be Christian. There's that story at the moment, isn't there, of that young man who murdered an older man who he befriended through their church, but always with the intention of cheating him. So perception of Christians might be really negative through that kind of contact. If they don't know that we are Christians, if they don't know that they have Christians living among them, if they don't know their neighbours, that's all they've got to go on, is these negative depictions that they see in the media. Or it might be indifference. They might think, yes, I know there are Christians. I know some Christians. Some of my family are Christians, they might say. But it has nothing to do with me. That's for them, and I'm happy for them, but I'm not personally challenged by that at all. And so I think we need to be realistic about that too. The fact that they might know we are Christians is not enough to make them feel any sense that it's something they need to do something about. So these are the implications of this post-Christian context that we live in. Some further research has been done by Theos. The Theos think tank is an organisation that produces detailed reports into a range of different social issues. And 3 or 4 years ago, they produced this report on the nuns. That means if you have got a survey to fill in, religion, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Buddhist, none. They tick the box, none. And so they call them the nuns. Who are they and what do they believe? And Theos identified basically three categories of nuns. It sounds a little bit weird saying it because we're all thinking of nuns in habits and things like that, but, you know, think of the spelling. Three categories of nuns. The spiritual nuns, this is really the people we were talking about yesterday. They say they have no religion, but there's all kinds of spiritual ideas going on. They're experimenting, they're curious, they're seeking. Maybe they think they've found the answers in their own personal combination of spiritual influences. Then there's the campaigning nuns. They're the ones at the other end of the spectrum who are virulently anti-Christian, who want to campaign against it, who want to point out all the time how bad it is, how crazy it is, how stupid it is, and just to kind of put that militant atheist perspective over. And then in between are what they call the tolerant nuns. These are people who are personally atheist or agnostic, but are kind of quite content that other people have different beliefs, including religious beliefs. And so they're kind of, you know, more comfortable. They're people who are likely to have Christian friends or family members or colleagues and to have a civilized conversation with you about it, but are absolutely not interested for themselves. And as we think about these three different groups, I hope you can see that the way that we might respond to them in terms of engaging with our post-Christian neighbours is going to be quite different. You know, the spiritual nuns, you can have a spiritual conversation with. You can talk about spiritual things and, you know, there's that openness to that. The campaigning nuns, you're very unlikely to be able to have a basically good conversation with them unless there's divine intervention breaking down the barriers they've got up against anything you might have to say. The tolerant nuns, you can have a very interesting conversation with them and it may make no difference whatsoever. So each of these groups presents slightly different challenges. I was thinking, how could I find some biblical paradigms to talk about this? When we're talking about a non-spiritual, people who have lost any sense of the sacred canopy, any sense of the spiritual as a reality in their lives, the Bible doesn't really talk about that much because in the ancient world, of course, everyone had some kind of religion or spirituality, almost everyone. I did manage to find a couple of examples. So let me talk about those. The first one is Paul's visit to Athens in Acts 17. If you've got your Bible, you might want to turn to Acts 17. I'm not going to read the whole passage out, but simply to refer to the context. So Paul is travelling alone at this point, which is very unusual because he always usually travelled with a team, with a group of friends, but for this particular reason. Others have gone on somewhere, or Paul has gone on ahead of them. They've taken different routes, and he's waiting for them in Athens. So the story starts in chapter 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he goes and does a bit of sightseeing. He goes and gets out into the city, and he notices that it is full of idols. And we have that whole conversation about the unknown God. And he discusses spiritual things with Jews and God-fearing Greeks. Notice people who are interested in spirituality. And then the philosophers come along and get involved in the conversation and ask him to come to their debating place, the Areopagus, and have another conversation with them. And then verse 22, he talks about their religiousness. He talks about their idols. He talks about the idol, the altar to an unknown God, that sense that there must be a spiritual something that they haven't quite been able to identify yet. And he talks about that and connects that to the God they don't yet know. And people are standing around listening. And this includes these philosophers and these other people who perhaps have a sense of spirituality. Now, I'm not going to go into the history of the different Greek philosophies, but there were certainly some which were functionally atheist who were saying, well, we reject the idea that there is a divine being. or any kind of afterlife or any kind of spiritual reality. And so they were quite happy to bounce ideas around. You could perhaps call them a tolerant nun. They were quite happy to bounce ideas around with him. But when he kind of got to the crunch, when he got to the facts of Jesus's life, death, and resurrection, that's it. We're not going there. So verse 31, we get to the end of Paul's little presentation, and he talks about what God will do. He has set a day, he says, when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed, Jesus. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. And when he mentions resurrection, there is a reaction. Verse 32, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others wanted to know more. And it's those sneerers who I think are close to the kind of reaction we might sometimes get from our post-Christian neighbours. This didn't compute. It didn't connect with what was going on in their worldview. And so they regarded it as ridiculous. They stopped listening. They went away. Others wanted to continue the conversation and met him another day. So what other examples can we think of? Another one I found, again coming from the book of Acts, is Paul's, again, encounter with Festus and Agrippa. So if you remember the story of Acts, Paul comes into the custody of the Romans. He's involved in all kinds of things in his life, as you know, riots and stonings and, you know, disputes and this and that. And at a certain point, he says, I want to be tried by Caesar. And he falls into the hands of the Romans. And he spends several years in the hands of the Romans in Palestine before he moves on to Rome. So he spends time there under the governor Felix. And then when Felix leaves, the next guy who comes along is Festus. And Festus wants to hear what this prisoner has got to say. And having heard it, he consults King Agrippa, who was king over Judea at the time. And so the image you see here is of Paul standing, talking to three very hostile-looking people. And of course, we don't know how true that is, but there's Agrippa on his throne on the left. There's Festus dressed in Roman attire with his crew cut, looking extremely sceptical. And there's the sister as well, Agrippa's sister, I think it is, listening. So what happens is Paul tells his story. He tells his testimony. He talks about the experience he has had of God. And he starts to challenge them. And then if you want to have a look in Acts 26, you can see the points at which these sceptical, not interested people start to object and start to put their feet down and say, no, that's not something I want to engage with. So he's been telling his story. He's talked about his own experiences. And then, again, it's when he talks about resurrection that the trouble starts. I'm just looking where to start reading. Verse 22, God has helped me to this very day, says Paul. So I stand here and testify to small and great alike. I'm saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Messiah would suffer, and as the first to rise from the dead would bring the message of light to his own people and the Gentiles. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defence. You are out of your mind, Paul, he shouted. As the first to rise from the dead, he would bring the message of light to his people. You are out of your mind. This cannot work in my worldview. And so at that point, Festus, the Roman, puts his foot down and says, I'm not going there anymore with this conversation. And then Paul responds and continues to now address his speech more to Agrippa, who had a Jewish background and would have been more familiar with some of the ideas he's talking about. Verse 26, the king is familiar with these things. I can speak freely to him. I'm convinced that none of this has escaped his notice. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? It's that challenge. King Agrippa, will you repent? Do you believe what the prophets are going to say? I know you do. And Agrippa says to Paul, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? It's like, I see what you're doing, Paul, and I'm not having it. You're not going to convert me. I'm not going to respond to your message. So just from these two examples from Acts, in a very different cultural setting, a setting where a spiritualized worldview was absolutely the norm, whether it be a pagan one like Festus's or a basically Jewish one like Agrippa's, there were still people who resisted the gospel. Resistance to the gospel is not a new thing. Hostility to the gospel is not a new thing. But we are moving into a time in the West where resistance or indifference or hostility is the norm rather than the exception. If we were writing stories now, no one would have to look very hard to find examples of stories where there's resistance and hostility, whereas I had to look quite hard to find those examples in Acts. Why is that? Let me give some historical perspective. This is a medieval map of the world, just as a backdrop for our thinking about the history. In terms of geographical reach of Christianity, in terms of where the heartlands of Christianity are, we live in a situation where this has changed. The heartlands of Christianity now are not the same as the heartlands of Christianity at the beginning, or the heartlands of Christianity 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's constantly shifting. And so if we think about the history of where Christianity is most strongly present, we see that former Christian heartlands have continually, constantly been replaced by new Christian heartlands. Just a few examples. North Africa, massively significant in early Christianity. Great theologians like Tertullian and Augustine were working there, based there. Alexandria was a major centre of the church. That's countries like Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, countries where now it is very hard to be a Christian, countries which you would now no longer call the Christian heartland, and yet back in the day they were, and they're not anymore. The Eastern Mediterranean, again, Antioch was a major sending place, Antioch in Syria, a major sending place in mission. Paul and Barnabas would go back there. Paul and Silas would go back there between their missionary trips for encouragement and sending out. It was their sending church. And now if you think of places like Syria, Lebanon, even Israel and Palestine, we don't think of those as the Christian heartland. It has moved, and what used to be the heartland isn't anymore. Similarly with Asia Minor, if you think of Ephesus, think of Constantinople, and then in the modern world we think of Turkey, it's no longer the Christian heartland that it once was. And in Asia, the Church of the East once spread all the way to China. It had the biggest geographical reach of any part of the church, covering Central Asia, Iran, Iraq, India, all the way to China, and it's now almost completely disappeared. What used to be the heartlands are not the heartlands anymore. Andrew Walls, the mission historian, said this: Christian faith must go on being translated, must continually enter into vernacular culture and interact with it, or it withers and fades. And if we think about these former heartlands which have now gone, we can see the truth of that. What used to be Christian places are Christian places no longer. And Walls would say part of that is because people stopped trying to see the people they lived amongst missionally. People stopped trying to contextualize. People stopped trying to make the gospel connect to the culture in fresh ways. And so it withered and faded. And I think it's worth considering whether that's what's happening in the West at the moment. One of the metaphors that I like to use when talking about this is the burning edge. If you set fire to a piece of paper, there's a kind of, once the flame has died down, there's a kind of burning edge, isn't there, that gradually propagates across the paper, and it leaves behind blackened ash, but it burns across the paper, gradually. And I think that's a really powerful image of what's happening, what Walls is saying is happening. The growth in Christianity occurs at the burning edge, occurs at the places where mission is being done. It occurs when people are working to make the gospel communicated in fresh ways, engaging with changing culture in fresh ways. Growth occurs where that work of connecting the gospel to culture is being actively pursued. It doesn't occur in the places which say, well, we're a Christian country, we'll just carry on as we always have done. What Walls says is that if we do that, if there's complacency and stagnation, if we carry on with business as usual, the fire moves on. The growth, the conversion, the gospel moves on, and the heartland will become somewhere else. If we look at the situation in world Christianity today, we can see that this has in fact happened. These are 2023 statistics, which show that now 2/3 of Christians in the world live in the global south. Whereas back in 1900, 80% of Christians lived in the global north, and the global south was the minority. Now it's completely flipped. Now, a typical Christian is someone in the global south. And in fact, the authors of this report said, a typical Christian today is a non-white woman living in the global south with a lower than average level of societal safety and proper health care. This is a vastly different typical Christian than that of 100 years ago, who was probably a white, affluent European. So all of this means that Christianity is now a majority global south religion. The West used to be a heartland. We still have enormous power. And there's all kinds of things I could say about that, which I haven't got time for today. We still have enormous power, but we are not the place where most Christians live. Most Christians live in the global south. Most people in the UK, more than half, do not identify as Christian, even residually. We need to re-engage with the UK. We need to have that flame, that burning edge here again. Or, to use Andrew Wall's words, we will wither and fade. If we're not treating our situation with engaging with our neighbours, if we're not treating that missionally, then the gospel is going to move on, as it always has done, into the places where people are being communicated with appropriately. Further implications: a mission focus, therefore, on engaging with our neighbours is urgent and essential. This will involve entering into culture and interacting with it. Again, quoting those words from earlier. And if we think about church and mission in the UK, we have so much to learn from the cross-cultural missions community, from those who've gone to other cultures, to other countries as missionaries. We need to have that same mindset now for doing mission in the West. We can't assume it's a Christian context. We can't assume even the most basic knowledge of the faith. We have to think of ourselves as missionaries in this context. Now, I spoke yesterday about worldview, and I used that image of an iceberg. You know, we can see certain things above the surface. Perhaps one of the things we can see above the surface is that people no longer go to church, people no longer claim to be Christian. Perhaps some of the things we can see above the surface are their attitudes, their behaviours. But then underneath that is a set of beliefs and values, and underneath that is the kind of basic gut-level understanding of how the world works and why, what we call worldview. And all of those things have changed. If you think back to the 1950s, you know, and come forward to now, all of those things have changed in terms of what's happening in the West. They've changed for us as Christian, modern Westerners. They've changed for those who are post-Christian. Culture is constantly changing. It always does. It always should. And for us to kind of have this kind of longing, oh, I wish it was like it was in the 1950s, or a kind of sense that we need to resist cultural change, is not really, I would argue, the right way to go about it. We need to recognise that culture is changing and think, how do I now connect the gospel to that changing culture? Rather than to put our feet down and say, I'm going to pretend that our culture hasn't changed and just keep doing what I've always done before. Culture is constantly changing, and not just on the surface, but at the level of values, at the level of beliefs, at the gut level of worldview and how people think that life works. I want to give you a couple of moments to talk to one another, reflect on this. What are the major changes that you have noticed in your own lifetime? For some of us, that's longer than others. But we will all, I think, have noticed some social and cultural changes in our own lifetime. If you can't think of any, think back to your grandparents' lifetime. What has changed since your grandparents' lifetime? And just share with one another for a couple of minutes about that as we think about cultural change. Okay? 2 minutes. I'm sure if I asked you what you've been talking about, there would be a whole range of different things. If we think about what's changed in society, what's changed in culture, we might be talking about migration, we might be talking about gender, we might be talking about technology, we might be talking about definitions of family, we might be talking about this whole post-Christian thing, a whole range of different things. And hopefully you've found some that you've been able to share with each other. The point is, culture is changing. Culture is constantly changing. And Christianity has always and will always be needing to connect with changing culture. We do this in mission. We go to cultures where the gospel has not been communicated before, and we find ways of communicating the gospel to the things that are live issues in that culture. We don't change the gospel. We don't change the Bible. But we find creative new ways to connect it to the culture. And we need to be doing the same with regard to the cultural changes that are happening in our own Western context. Christianity is constantly encountering new cultures, new contexts, and they demand new responses. We need to be at that burning edge. We need to not be at the kind of the fire has moved on, dead ash kind of part of that page. The gospel has always crossed borders, and it must continue to do so today. Again, if I was to look back in history, we'd be talking about how the gospel hopped between different places. So just around the time of the fall of Rome and the fall of the Roman Empire, the gospel had already crossed over to Northern European tribes, to the Anglo-Saxons. It already crossed over to the East. It was, you know, it was on the move, and the same thing happens again and again and again. The gospel has always crossed borders. How are we going to cross the borders that exist in our own communities among people who would identify as British, people who would identify as Western even? There are new borders there, and we need to work out how to cross those. And so if we think about some of these nuns, the spiritual nuns, the tolerant nuns who will have a smooth conversation with us, be totally unchanged by it, the campaigning nuns who will want a good argument or want to avoid us completely because we're just beneath their notice. You know, how are we going to do that? How are we going to contextualise, connect the everlasting gospel, the good news of Jesus, to this change in culture? And as I thought about that, I was reminded of the story from the Bible of Ezekiel. At a time when everything seemed to have gone wrong for the Jewish people, they were in exile. Everything seemed to have died. If you asked him where the burning edge was, it was not in Babylon. They were there as exiles. Everything was a disaster. And he had this vision of dead bones, completely lifeless, no hope. And God says to him, can these bones live? And he says, well, only you know that, Lord. And then the vision shows that, yes, new life can come, even to something which is completely hopeless, as it was in his vision of the valley of dead bones. I think when we're talking about the post-Christian context, it's not a matter of tools and techniques and quick evangelism guides and 10 steps to whatever. It's a recognition that we need God to do this. It's God's mission. We need to be prayerful. We need to recognize that this is only going to change with his intervention, his acts of power, his acts of opening people's eyes when they were closed and hostile and ignoring the truth of the gospel. We need to be listening to him. We need to be expecting him to work. We need to think, not be thinking it's all about us. It's not all about us. It's all about him. And the outcome actually doesn't depend on us. And yet, we have this story from the Gospels, the story of the sower. As you know, when you think of the story of the sower, here's this man throwing out the seed, and some of it is never going to bear fruit. Some of it lands on the path. Some of it lands in rocky places. Some of it lands among thorns. And that's the same for us in this post-Christian context. We need to do our part. We need to be sowing the seed. And some of it will fall on barren soil, will fall on rocks, will fall among thorns. There are some people who will not want to hear. God can still change that. But our part is to keep sowing the seed and to be doing it in a way that works. Still other seed fell on good soil where it produced a crop. So the outcome doesn't depend on us, but we still need to sow the seed. We still need to be thinking missionally, to be connecting to this new post-Christian context, just as we would in any other mission context, by doing our best to understand what is going on in these people's hearts. What are their needs? Where does good news need to land for them? What does my story have to say to their story? And how can I earn the right to share my story? So we need to treat this as cross-cultural mission. And I would say that we can learn a lot from cross-cultural mission. And one of the things we can learn from that is that we need to make the effort to understand the culture rather than just say it ought to be something other than it is. It is what it is. We need to try and understand it so that we can communicate the gospel appropriately, treating it as mission. And so there are various things that we can learn from the cross-cultural missions world. Things like approaches to church planting, where we need to be intentional. You know, if we're sending a church planter into a tribal area in Cambodia, it's an intentional thing. It's a life commitment thing. How does that help us to think about how we do mission in our own context? It needs commitment. It needs planning. It needs attention to good practice. It needs all of these things. Another thing we can learn from the cross-cultural missions community is the need for contextualization. We need to seek to understand the culture so that we can communicate appropriately. And I've used an image here of an apple tree, something that grows happily and easily in British soil, and a mango. You know, and you might be able to grow a mango in British soil, but you'd probably need to put an awful lot of effort into it and a greenhouse and tropical humidity levels and I don't know what else. It's not designed for that. It's not contextualized. We need to communicate the gospel in a way that connects to our neighbor's context. We need to understand culture. At this point, I want to do a little plug for a course that's available through All Nations, a four-week course for churches to do as church house groups or whatever, thinking missionally about our own context. It's called Envision, God's Mission, Our Role. There'll be flyers at the back when you leave, and I really encourage you to have a look at it and to consider whether it's something that might help your church to be thinking missionally about the post-Christian landscape that we live in. Let me use my last little while thinking about a case study. Post-Christian rural England. In many ways, I think rural mission is one of the most challenging aspects of mission in the UK at the moment. And if we had another hour, I would get you to work through a kind of church planting strategy, for want of a better word, with regard to this scenario. But let me just paint a picture. I want you to imagine you live in a town, a rural market town with a big church, which has a children's work, which has therefore attracted all the Christian families from the surrounding area to come to your church. As a result, the village chapels have been left to be run by elderly people. It's not really been possible for them to connect easily with the people in the village. And one by one, those chapels have closed. And so the situation is there are villages around you where the chapel has closed. And you have found out through your research, through doing this missionally and intentionally, that people in those communities struggle with all kinds of social issues, social isolation, particularly for those who haven't got their own transport or who are home workers or who are disabled. Lack of affordable housing, meaning people move away. No community hubs left. So the pub has closed. The post office has closed. Everything has closed. It's really hard to meet new people unless you have children or a dog. And so, you know, how do you connect? And most people there have never been to church, in common with most people in the UK. How might you engage the unreached people of this context? And we haven't got time to talk that through, but I want to say that you need to engage it intentionally. You need to be thinking missionally. If you are a member of this big, relatively prosperous and relatively viable church, what's your part in going out to these rural communities and reconnecting, reigniting the burning edge of mission in those places? How can you do that in ways that are going to be meaningful and relevant? As I said yesterday, when we talked about our spiritual neighbours, I think that it's really important for us to be thinking of neighbours, not targets. These are people we live amongst, we share our lives with. We are part of their world, they are part of our world. And so when we think about engaging them, we're not talking about quick fix solutions. We're talking about mission at walking pace. Remember that 3 mile an hour model of mission. Talking about slow, continuing, constant, steadfast, reliable. We are part of their world as they're part of ours. We're talking about mission as dialogue, listening as well as speaking, understanding as well as trying to make them understand us. We're looking for new ways to connect. We're making time to listen. And we're building genuine, long-term, reciprocal relationships with the people we live amongst. This, I think, is key in that rural setting and in other urban settings as well. When I worked this scenario with my church planting module students a few years ago, you know, we talked about what you could do to build those bridges, to connect to people, to earn the right to share the gospel. We talked about that as a mission setting. But I just want to leave you with an example of someone who I think is a much overlooked person in the book of Acts, and who I think has got a lovely story. And this is Dorcas. I don't know how much time you've given to thinking about Dorcas. She only gets a few verses in the story. But it's a beautiful story. Let me read it to you. Acts 9, verse 36. In Joppa, now Jaffa, near Tel Aviv, in Joppa there was a disciple named Tabitha. In Greek, her name is Dorcas. She was always doing good and helping the poor. About that time, she became ill and died, and her body was washed and placed in an upper room. Lydda was near Joppa, so when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, "Please come at once." Peter went with them, and when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. All the widows stood around him, crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. And that's why I've used this picture of a woman sewing. Because Dorcas was someone who was connected to her community. She was a befriender. You know, you've got these widows standing there with Peter saying, "Look, look at this beautiful thing she made me," weeping. Their friend has died. She is part of them. She has earned their love. She has shown love to them. She has served her community. It says she was always doing good and helping the poor. And of course, widows were amongst the poorest of the poor at that time, people who were destitute by definition, no husband to provide for them. And she had provided for them. She had sewn them clothes. She had cared for them. She had shown them love. She had made them things that were beautiful. And they loved her. And she was part of their community. And that response to her is, I think, the thing that makes this such a beautiful story. She is a woman who is a neighbour, a good neighbour. And her neighbours loved her. And, spoilers, she is raised back to life again. And everyone rejoices. I think hers is a beautiful example of what mission can look like. That unspectacular, long-term, relational, servant-hearted, beautiful living alongside our neighbours. So let me leave you with this. We are the light of the world. You can imagine this being said to Dorcas or to us. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, here's what we do as good neighbours. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Let's pray together. Father God, as we did yesterday, we thank you that you have placed us in communities. And we pray that you will give us that vision for how to reach the communities you have placed us with, how to connect to people, how to love people, how to genuinely value them as they are, so that we can share the gospel with them in a way that connects with them. So we pray, Lord, that you will give us that heart for them, that love for them, that vision for how to reach them, that your kingdom may spark into flame here, that we may once again be the burning edge where growth is happening and many, many people are coming to a transforming knowledge of you. We pray for your blessing, Lord.